Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 5th of February. This week, the U.S. Senate is set to vote on reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act. In fact, yesterday, the Senate started discussion about this. This was first passed in 1994 and has been reauthorized twice without much drama. It's considered a no-brainer vote, a way for both parties to join hands and express their opposition to violence against women. But last April, when the Senate handed the reauthorization over to the House, some Republican members were very concerned about three new provisions, one that would expand protection for gays and lesbians, another, the same protection for Native Americans, and a third covered undocumented immigrants. And so we get the debate again. We have, as our guest this hour, Lisa Lynn Jacobs, who is Vice President for Government Relations at Legal Momentum, the Women's Legal Defense Fund. And we'll be welcoming phone calls from you, as we always do. The phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, if you'd like to get a hold of us that way, is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Lisa Lynn Jacobs, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. Let's start with a little bit of history of this. Let's go back to 1994 and why we first had a bill.
The Violence Against Women Act is one of the signature accomplishments of our now Vice President, Joe Biden. He was then a member of the Judiciary Committee, in fact, the chair of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate. And after a number of years of hearings and talking to women's rights advocates and domestic and sexual violence advocates, he became convinced that there needed to be a comprehensive and coordinated federal response on issues of domestic violence. He became convinced that it was a national issue, that it was affecting the economy. These are sort of constitutional thresholds you have to meet if you are going to pass a national law of this nature that really is going to affect things that are going on at the state level. And so VAWA was enacted in 1994, as you pointed out, as part of a larger comprehensive crime bill. You or your audience may be familiar with President Clinton was in the White House at that point, and he used to talk about the COPS program, community-oriented policing,
yes,
putting 100,000 new cops on the beat.
Mm-hmm.
COPS was also part of that same 1994 crime bill that created VAWA, because it was the sense of the Senate in particular, but working in close coordination with the House, that there needed to be a more focused and national response on some of these significant crime issues, including violence against women, but that there also needed to be the resources in terms of law enforcement to be sufficiently responsive on these issues.
And my understanding is that it is to give law enforcement, prosecutors, judges, what they need to hold offenders accountable and keep communities safe while supporting victims. What does that mean?
You have hit the nail right on the head. In fact, I welcome you to come down here to Washington and get on the lobbying trail with us, because you are 100% right in that particular regard. The goal of the Violence Against Women Act was to try to get all the actors that you have just named, whether or not we are talking about cops or prosecutors or judges or domestic and sexual violence advocates, to get around a table and to coordinate the response, to the end that they would provide the best service, whether by a conviction of an abuser or the providing of domestic or sexual violence-related counseling or supports, that they would provide the most comprehensive and responsive set of services to survivors of domestic and sexual violence, dating violence, and stalking.
Have they done that?
You know, I think the evidence on the Violence Against Women Act really speaks for itself. It is now, I guess it will turn 19 later this year. It has, by all accounts and by all statistical analysis, improved the ability of the criminal justice system to keep victims safe. The annual incidence of domestic violence has dropped more than 50% since VAWA became law. It has provided victims with the kinds of services that I have described, but it's focused in very targeted ways on the fact that different victims have different needs. So VAWA focuses on a variety of issues, including transitional housing, victims' needs for legal assistance, They look particularly, VAWA addresses, you know, the specific needs of victims in rural areas, of elderly victims, of victims with disabilities. And as I've said, VAWA is a law that focuses on four key crimes: domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, and stalking. The other thing I would say at the outset is that the name of the law is the Violence Against Women Act, and that's a reflection of the fact that women are disproportionately the victims of the kinds of crimes that we are talking about. They are about 88, they comprise about 88% of the victims who are served by domestic violence shelters or crisis hotlines or other things. But the Violence Against Women Act is, in fact, gender neutral. It serves men as well. It serves gays and lesbians. I think you will probably get into a discussion about
yes.
what the provisions in the, you know, in the current proposal before the Senate and the House speak to. But it is a law that tries to meet victims where they are, whether the victims are gay or straight, male or female, old or young, rural or urban. And it has done that, I would say, in increments. You talked about how the law has been reauthorized successfully several times. Each time the law has been reauthorized, those of us in Washington who do the advocacy have spent a series of months on the phone talking with local advocates, advocates in Wisconsin, advocates across the country, to find out what they are hearing, what they are seeing as they work with their clients, and to try to shape a proposal for Congress that is as comprehensive and responsive as we can possibly make it. And that is what we then, you know, propose to the Congress in terms of what a Violence Against Women Act should look like. And then, you know, obviously the Congress has its own sense about that. Every member of Congress likely has a domestic violence shelter or a crisis hotline or something in his or her district from whom they will hear. And the discussions then back and forth between the advocates and the people on Capitol Hill then shape what a Violence Against Women Act reauthorization proposal looks like.
I see. As you well know, we had a horrendous incident that was much publicized nationally in a spa where a woman's husband came in and killed her and killed other people in the spa. Horrendous act of domestic violence. In subsequent shows on that particular incident, I was talking to people from shelters in this area, and they gave incredible numbers of the women that they house each year. Mm-hmm. I was surprised to hear you say that the rate of domestic violence has gone down so significantly.
Well, I think that it's a reflection of the fact that VAWA is able to, and I did not say this precisely, I should have, but, you know, one of the great triumphs, one of the great abilities that the Violence Against Women has is to provide federal funds to state entities that then I described before, that the goal of VAWA really is to foster coordination at the state level. What VAWA does, among other things, VAWA is basically sort of part federal statute, so there are crimes, you know, federal crimes if you cross state lines to commit an act of domestic violence, for instance. But VAWA also provides significant grant funding at the state level, so that the states can coordinate in the way that I described, and that coordination, the ability to get law enforcement in the room with advocates and to figure out what they're going to do about issues like protective order enforcement or how they are going to work in the context of a courthouse to ensure that a victim is safe and does not have to interact with an abuser, et cetera. The ability to respond in that coordinated way, combined with the funds that go to domestic and sexual violence and dating violence and stalking service providers, has shown us the dramatic results that I described in terms of the decrease in the incidence of domestic violence.
So let's get to how this would change. It would expand the Violence Against Women Act, and the big three are protections for immigrant women, for LGBT women, and protections for tribal women. These have become controversial, is that a correct word to use, provisions in terms of how some Republicans are seeing this legislation?
Yes, I think that is correct.
Why?
You know, it's really kind of interesting. I ask myself the question why all the time, because the reality is the existing Violence Against Women Act, both in terms of what it says, but also in the way that it is administered by the U.S. Justice Department, already contains protections for all three of those groups. The Violence Against Women Act has addressed the needs of Native American women since its first iteration in 1994. The same is true of immigrant women. It has certainly been the view of the U.S. Justice Department that the Violence Against Women Act should also serve lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered people. But VAWA, in that unique regard, I think, has been a victim of its own success, because you heard me describe before that it serves so many different communities, whether or not they are rural communities or you know, serving the needs of the elderly, etc. Those particular communities, if you will, rural communities, communities of people with disabilities and others, are specified in the Violence Against Women Act. They're spelled out. And because the Violence Against Women Act is silent when it comes to the fact that services should be provided to the LGBT community, some state administrators have expressed concern that perhaps they are not supposed to be covered. But again, it is the view of the U.S. Justice Department that those services are to be provided. So particularly with respect to the LGBT community, the provision of these services are not new. We are just trying to be explicit about the fact that those services are supposed to be available because state administrators, some of them, have expressed some concern about that. But with respect to the programming for immigrant women in particular, those services and programs already exist in the Violence Against Women Act. The single most controversial, I would say, piece of the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization focused on immigrant women would have ensured that U visas, a limited number of U visas, additional U visas, were made available to victims of crime, immigrant victims of crime, who were cooperating with law enforcement.
U visa? What is that?
A U visa is something that an immigrant, generally an undocumented immigrant victim of crime, would receive from law enforcement in exchange for their cooperation. You know, if, for instance, the immigrant is, you know, if they are married to someone who is committing crimes themselves, mm-hmm. you know, they may. And what then would happen would be, and what we find in those relationships is that the immigrant is often manipulated by the person who is the U.S. citizen. Their path to citizenship is held over their head, as in, you know, the abusive spouse may say, if you don't sell drugs for me or if you don't prostitute yourself, I will not, you know, file your papers for lawful permanent residence. If law enforcement can make a case based on the testimony of the immigrant, they will in many instances offer that immigrant a path to citizenship by providing them a U visa. So a U visa is something that law enforcement would make available to a victim of crime if that victim was cooperating with law enforcement. That whole process was created when the Violence Against Women Act was reauthorized in 2005. But what happened was that the Department of Homeland Security took some time in setting up the literal process for that to happen, in drafting and promulgating regulations. And while that was happening, VAWA had contemplated that a certain number of U visas would be made available every year, but those visas couldn't be made available until the Department of Homeland Security completed its regulatory process. So what that meant was that there were visas that basically expired. They were never made available to victims of crime because the Department of Homeland Security had not at that point acted.
Mm-hmm.
So the single most controversial provision, the U visa provision, which I think some people wrongly argued, you know, either would sort of open the floodgates to immigrants, et cetera, the U visa provision was only ever designed to make a limited number of additional visas available because of what had happened with the delay on the part of the Department of Homeland Security. But, you know, also there were allegations made that somehow the process that in general immigrants trying to become U.S. citizens by coming forward and saying that they were victims of domestic violence were somehow, you know, at some great likelihood of committing fraud, et cetera. One of the other things that the Violence Against Women Act does is to consolidate the process whereby an immigrant victim of violence can apply for their own citizenship. So all of those applications are processed only in one location in the United States, and that's in Vermont. And, you know, their rate of declining people who are applying to go through that process is quite a significant one. So, again, the claims of fraud made by some people who are expressing concerns about the immigration provisions were, you know, frankly, unfounded.
Mm-hmm. Now, yesterday, the conversation in the Senate concerned Native Americans. Senator Chuck Grassley of Ohio was talking about the issues of trying accused non-Native American abusers on reservations in tribal courts, right, which he said brings up the question of sovereignty and constitutional rights. Does he have a point?
You know, I think that, and I say this as someone, I've been working on the Violence Against Women Act on again, off again, really more on again, since 1995. I was working for the U.S. Justice Department when the law came to justice to do the implementation. And as a consequence of that, I know a decent amount about tribal law, and it is very complicated. So with much due respect paid to Senator Grassley, I do not think that his assertions about the constitutionality concerns are well-founded. The thing that I would point out is that the provisions with respect to jurisdiction over non-natives in Indian country were drafted and put forward by our U.S. Justice Department, which in my experience, and I think in the experience of many, is not in the practice of putting forward unconstitutional provisions. The Justice Department is the nation's law firm, is by its own creation or by its own notion a very conservative entity. So they would in no respect have put forward a proposal that they thought would, you know, suffer from any kind of constitutional infirmity. Indian tribal law is actually quite complicated, but the proposal that we are discussing is actually quite modest. And it's a proposal that would only apply to non-natives who had significant ties to Indian country, whether or not they were living there or were in a relationship with a native individual who lived in Indian country. You know, I think a lot of people have expressed the erroneous concern that if this provision were passed into law, that somehow, you know, somebody went into Indian country to go to a casino and got into a fight, that they would then be tried in a tribal court. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The provisions are very narrow and targeted and focused on the fact that Native women suffer violence at rates that are epidemic,
really,
compared to any other group of people in the country. You know, I think maybe about 25% of the U.S. population is likely to be a victim of domestic or sexual violence at some time. But for Native women, the chances of being sexually assaulted if you are a Native woman rises to about 1 in 3.
Ooh.
And the incidence of domestic violence is even more severe. I'm sure that you're aware there are a number of Native tribes there in Wisconsin, I believe, including the Menominee tribe.
Yes.
So with luck, you know, maybe some of them will be able to call in during that part of your program and, you know, offer some local context on this. But, you know, it was the conclusion of the Department of Justice that local prosecutors and local courts in Indian country needed every tool at their disposal to be able to respond to the epidemic levels of violence in Indian country. In many places, it is the primary responsibility of the federal government to prosecute those kinds of crimes. But various places in Indian country can be located in, you know, very remote regions compared to where your, you know, courthouse is or your prosecutors are. So the federal government, while it, you know, has dedicated significant resources to trying to respond to this problem, felt like it needed a stronger partnership and needed to enable local law enforcement and local tribal courts to be able to try to hold abusers accountable. Because, I mean, I've heard horrific stories of abusers who literally serially go from reservation to reservation to reservation in Indian country, whether or not they are child abusers or they're committing domestic violence or assaults. They do it because they know they're beyond the reach of the law. Because as is currently constituted, if, you know, a non-native cannot be tried in a tribal court. And, you know, the Justice Department rightly, in working with the Obama administration at the helm of this, concluded that there needed to be more resources on the ground in order to try to respond to this huge tragedy.
Lisa Lynn Jacobs is our guest, and this will be the part of the show that we invite you to join the conversation. She is Vice President for Government Relations at Legal Momentum, the Women's Legal Defense Fund, and as you heard her say, she's been working on the Violence Against Women Act since 1995. There's controversy about its reauthorization. We have yet to talk about a couple still big areas, why it is that, as she graphically outlined, the violence against women is so profound in Indian country and why it still is in this country, where 25% of the population is experiencing some form of violence. There also is a political element to all of this as well. The Democrats have really taken this up as a very big issue. Congresswoman Gwen Moore, who, of course, is from the state of Wisconsin and was the sponsor of the legislation in both the 112th Congress and this one, said that women are seeing the retrograde direction of the Republican Party, and no amount of cleaning up their talking points is going to change their efforts to keep us barefoot and pregnant. This is the tip of the iceberg. If they can't pass a law to protect women's basic safety, are these the folks that you want to trust to take care of you in other areas? Are Republicans aware of a gender gap, and are they aware of the words from Gwen Moore, and that some people may agree with what she had to say, or is that over the top? What do you think? We welcome your phone calls. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm particularly interested in hearing from those of you who work in the area of violence against women. Is this a significant change to the act, and does it need to be passed, or is it going too far? The concerns about reauthorization are protections for immigrant women, protections for LGBT women, and protections for tribal women. To your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this morning. It should be really interesting. The Tracy Kidder, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and has been with us on several occasions, and his editor, and this man has been editing his work since back in the 70s. They've worked together for 40 years. Richard Todd have written a book, Good Prose, The Art of Nonfiction, Stories and Advice from a Lifetime of Writing and Editing. So that's coming up, hour two of our program. To your phone calls now at 800-486-8655. June in Shawano is our first caller. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen, and to your guests. Shawano has a domestic abuse house, which was built in 2003, I believe, due to a wonderful donor who gave the money. It started with five women who took a phone home every night and took calls, and gradually got better in terms of monetary support from the state. Tommy Thompson, our former governor of many years, was very pro-action against domestic abuse. Of course, he's changed a bit in the period of change since the Republicans have changed, but he was very good about that. And personally, I have a friend there who no longer works there, but when she did, she trained the police, both county and city, regarding the way domestic abuse people should be handled. And she stood by them in court, particularly sexual assault, which is very hard. She went to the hospital and did many things for people who were victims. Now, regarding the Menominees, I live just a block from the Menominee Reservation, and I'm familiar that Menominee women who have been victims of domestic abuse, a few, but not too many, have gone to the center and have been helped. And my question is there anything in the law about domestic abuse against men? There is not so often physical abuse, but psychological abuse, and I know it does occur.
Lisa Lynn.
Yes, absolutely, Kathleen, and you may have heard me refer to that a little earlier when I pointed out that although the name of the Violence Against Women Act has women in the title, that it is, in fact, gender neutral. Any man who seeks out services from a domestic violence or sexual assault or crisis hotline will be provided those services. I think we sometimes hear concerns expressed because shelters do not provide services to male victims and women victims in the same location. So sometimes men will complain about having been turned away from a shelter. But it's my general experience and understanding that a man who is fleeing domestic violence and needs to, you know, have those kinds of services will be given a voucher or some kind of other support from a domestic violence shelter so that, you know, he can find some safe place to reside while he's trying to resolve those issues.
Let's talk about the politics of this for just a moment, Lisa Lynn. Considering the fact that there is a gender gap and Republicans need to pay attention to bills that primarily affect women, and they've received so much criticism for stripping these elements from the bill, do you see a change? You follow this very closely. Do you see more Republicans embracing the addition of these protections?
Well, you know, I think you pointed out probably at the top of the show, Kathleen, that the Violence Against Women Act is a law that has historically enjoyed an amazing degree of bipartisan support. And it is well to be said that when the two bills were introduced, the bill introduced by the Republican House in the last Congress, as well as the bill introduced by Senator Leahy, that there was probably, I would say, 70 to 75% of those two bills overlapped, literally, that they were, you know, fairly well identical. The big three, as we have been discussing, were the key areas of divergence. Mm-hmm. But so, I mean, I think there clearly are some philosophical and substantive perspective differences as between the Republicans leading the House and the Democrats who are in charge of the U.S. Senate. I think there continues to be on the part of both parties a commitment to eradicating, ultimately, violence against women and men. But what we really are talking about, and you could hear this in Senator Grassley's remarks yesterday, what we really are talking about is what the appropriate, you know, approach and response should be. And as I pointed out before, when advocates like myself talk to Capitol Hill about the need to renew a Violence Against Women Act, it's after we've spent a significant period of time in conversation with folks, you know, in the state of Iowa, sure, where Senator Grassley is from, and folks in Congresswoman Moore's district. And I want to pause for a moment to just commend her for her tremendous commitment on these issues. There is a companion bill to the Senate bill that's going to be debated in the Senate later this week. It's H.R. 11. Congresswoman Moore and other Democrats have introduced that. We're hopeful that that is something that will get some serious consideration by the House Republicans. I think as a substantive matter, there is a commitment on the part of both parties to eradicating violence against women. But they do sometimes say that the devil is in the details. And I think that the Senate bill hews far more closely to what advocates have urged be done in terms of trying to respond to some of these pernicious issues.
June, thanks for your call. Marlene in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi. Hello. Good morning. Okay. I'm going to try to sound coherent in this. I believe an assault is an assault, whether it happens in a home or on the street corner. Now, when it's in your home where you expect to be safe, of course it's a different violent act. But once it happens, you aren't any more safe than if you were standing on that street corner. Now, what offends me, and I hope that it is addressed in this conversation, is my experience with shelters. And there are sources out there for men or women, but we're talking about women, to not be in this situation. The dance cannot continue without two people. If you're taken out along with your children and put in a safe environment and then choose to go back again and again, I do not look at this as a violence against women. I'm almost offended by it, because there are resources out there, and I'm not talking about the psychological reasons why maybe a woman goes back. We're talking about assault, period, and safety for a person and their children mainly. And the dance cannot happen without two people. Please talk about that.
Lisa Lynn.
Well, I think your caller is correct about there being two people involved in that relationship. But what is also true is that there is a significant power imbalance as between the two. We were talking before about immigrant women. If the victim in that relationship is the immigrant, the partner can hold the threat of deportation over that person's head. You know, even if you're talking about two U.S. citizens, the abusive partner may be the breadwinner in the family. And so, you know, often it is the tragic situation where the victim stays with an abuser because she needs to put food on the table for her children, or because, you know, the abuser has threatened, and we certainly have seen this in any number of instances, and you describe the situation in Wisconsin. You know, there are instances in which the abuser has firearms or other things and threatens the victim or threatens the well-being of the victim's child. So it's, and we all know that the time in which a victim is most endangered is when he or she makes that decision to leave, which is why the services of domestic and sexual violence shelters are available and counseling is available, and counselors can help victims make safety plans. But it is rarely the case, I think, that any advocate would advise a victim to merely leave without, you know, a set of plans in place, not only about where they would go, but about how they could be economically self-supporting and how they could get, you know, their life as well as potentially the lives of their children back on track.
Lisa Lynn, I have read, and I'm wondering if you can confirm this, that the extension reauthorization of this with the additional three areas would extend federal protection to about 30 million more women. Is that about right?
You know, I think we as advocates, that certainly is what I have heard a number of particularly women senators say during these discussions. I think that those of us who are advocates, although, you know, any particular shelter could tell you how many people they've served on a particular day or could give you an estimate, I think we're a little bit more reticent about putting sort of a particular figure on it. But, you know, certainly if you would like, I can talk in some detail about ways in which we are fairly well convinced that VAWA really has saved you know, significant amounts of money with respect to, as I suggested, the decline in domestic violence or the provision of services, or, you know, there are a number of other ways where we think that the program has been successful.
Well, in many ways, it's probably changed the entire way that people deal with victims of domestic violence and assault in all the areas that you're working with, in terms of police officers and how they're trained in this area, in terms of all kinds of areas, don't you think?
No, I think that's absolutely true. And the other thing that we point out often, particularly in terms of the way that, you know, VAWA is a program that is not only life-saving, but, you know, economically forward-looking, if you will, is that this current reauthorization is also focused on consolidating programs. We want to reduce administrative costs and avoid duplication. We would consolidate 13 existing programs if this current Violence Against Women Act proposal were to be passed into law. But there are also, I should say briefly so that you can take some more callers, there are a number of key ways in which this new VAWA reauthorization is a step forward beyond the big three, which we, you know, have already discussed. One is that it has a renewed focus on sexual assault issues. There are new purpose areas to improve law enforcement and forensic responses and to help address the backlogs of undetected rape kits. And, you know, the key source of funding, which sends money from the federal government to the state level, is going to be realigned in this particular reauthorization so that more funding can be addressed to the needs of survivors of sexual assault. You know, those are just a couple of ways in which the Violence Against Women Act, as currently constituted, would be strengthened and would be able to improve its response to survivors of violence.
We go to Isaiah in Lac des Flambeaux. Hi, Isaiah.
Hi. I just wanted to say, as an American Indian and someone who's been the victim of domestic violence and sexual assault, it's a big, huge problem in Indian country. And anecdotally, over half of the female American Indians I know and many of the male American Indians I know have experienced sexual assault or domestic violence. And I think a previous caller who talked about people returning to their abuser, that person I don't think understood the cycle of abuse and how to properly support victims of domestic violence. I volunteer at the local domestic violence shelter here on the reservation. And one thing that I guess I wanted to ask about is, while I wholeheartedly think we need to support VAWA, what about prevention, and how are we working to prevent this in the future and educate our young men and women growing up about domestic violence and how not to try and control relationships but have them be healthy?
It's a terrific question. And Isaiah, let me ask you, because you're living this, why do you think, I'm astounded by this rate of violence in Indian country, why is it so extensive? Why is it so pervasive?
I think some of it has to do with historical and generational trauma, like with how the government treated us and then how it affected our traditional masculine and feminine roles and the role of women and the role of men and how that was all many times turned upside down. And I think also people for years have taken advantage of American Indians, and some people still choose to, and it's a lot about power and control. And when you come from a culture that has been made powerless, other people sometimes see that, and abusers can find people like that very easily. They're sort of, I don't know, trained to do it, or trained is probably not the right word, but they have ability to do that, and so they seek those people out. And on reservations, they know they can get away with it. The reservation I come from, people get raped all the time, and the only people who could come in and do it when it's a non-Indian and an Indian are the FBI, and they're not going to come in and, quote-unquote, waste their time working on something so menial as domestic violence or sexual assault.
Seriously, people come into the reservation all the time to perpetrate this kind of violence? This is terrible.
I agree.
Lisa Lynn.
And that's exactly what I was saying about the perspective of the U.S. Justice Department in itself putting forward those provisions that would put the ability to prosecute non-natives into the hands of local courts and local tribal prosecutors. I mean, I think Isaiah is completely correct in the sense that, you know, a federal U.S. attorney has a huge portfolio, whether or not they're dealing with trafficking or drug violations or other things, And while I don't think it's the intent of any U.S. attorney to sort of trivialize what is happening with a particular situation in Indian country, when they look, I think, at their entire portfolio and the fact that they often end up prosecuting the kinds of crimes we're discussing as misdemeanors, when they look at the sort of scarce resources they have in terms of prosecutors or investigators, et cetera, and as I was describing before, if you are talking about a reservation that's located at some significant distance from where a U.S. attorney's office is, by the time they could send out a prosecutor or by the time the FBI could get out there, you know, the witnesses have, you know, gone and, you know, the abuser may no longer be in Indian country or no one may know where they are. And it's just very complicated in that particular way.
Mm-hmm. And what about Isaiah's large point, which is a huge issue? What do we do about prevention? How do we get rid of this in our society?
There are significant resources already in the law, but also additional resources contemplated in the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act to deal with prevention-related issues. Whether or not it is coaching, there's a program called Coaching Young Boys into Men to try and deal with some of the masculinity issues that I think Isaiah was talking about. So there is, you know, modeling of what appropriate, respectful, intimate partner relationships are, because when in the context of, you know, I think Isaiah was talking to some extent about ways in which native culture has been, if you will, disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a need to sort of reestablish what that, you know, the fact that, at least as I understand it, and I've had the privilege of working with many Native American advocates, in almost all the tribes and all the cultures that I have had the, you know, privilege to work with, women are venerated within those cultures, but some of the interaction with non-natives has disrupted some of those cultural perspectives. And so making sure that folks have the opportunity to, you know, hear within their own community what their history actually is, with an eye towards, you know, returning to a culture that respects and venerates women, I think is a part of that process.
Mm-hmm.
And is part of, you know, funding that flows to coalitions of Native women advocates who do this kind of work, in addition to trying to respond to the scourge of violence against women in Indian country.
Isaiah, send us more information about the shelter that you work at and what you're doing. We're probably interested in doing a subsequent show on this. Lisa Lynn Jacobs, Vice President for Government Relations at Legal Momentum, the Women's Legal Defense Fund, is with us this hour. We are talking about the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, which has run into some trouble, and we've been explaining why that is the case. We're looking at the history, its controversial provisions, and how Congress is, although we have yet to get to this, expected to vote on it. Will there be a vote later this week? Which way is it likely to go? More phone calls momentarily. One line is open for you. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, a collaboration between a Pulitzer Prize winning author and his longtime editor. It's a memoir, a conversation, and a master class. Tracy Kidder and Richard Todd on Good Prose, the Art of Nonfiction, Stories and Advice from a Lifetime of Writing and Editing. Back to phone calls. Steve in Watertown. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for my call here. I know Isaiah just kind of, he hit it on the head as far as the prevalence of domestic violence and even sexual violence in tribal communities, but, and so I'm going to kind of repeat a little bit of what he said, but with my experience in law enforcement in Wisconsin, obviously off of tribal lands, but the disproportionate prevalence of alcohol abuse and alcoholism in tribal communities, how does that correlate to the disproportionate amount of women that are subject to violence and, you know, domestic violence and sexual violence? And I guess my concern was more these bills and these laws are, and law enforcement in general, are reactive measures. You know, what do we do after the fact versus what type of proactive measures are being looked at And I think there's a major relationship between the alcohol and substance abuse and domestic violence and sexual violence. And then, I guess, going away from tribal communities, but because tribal communities have their own laws that they abide by, what about the Amish communities in Wisconsin with the growing population of Amish folks? It is almost taboo to get law enforcement involved in any of their dealings. They deal with everything internally within their community, but on that token, aren't Amish women and victims of violence and whether it be domestic or sexual, don't they have the same protections under the Constitution and federal laws that non-Amish community citizens would have?
All right, thanks, Steve. Let's start with the issue of drug abuse and alcoholism, not just as it pertains to Indian country, but how it may be associated with violence and domestic abuse across the board. Is there a correlation, Lisa Lynn?
I think you obviously find that in the context of a relationship where one or more persons is struggling, where there is dysfunction and, you know, there's abuse of a substance, whether alcohol or drugs or something else, that can fuel a propensity for violence. It never creates it. That is to say, if you're a person who's by your nature not violent, drinking is not going to yield any type of different or aberrant behavior in all likelihood. However, you know, in communities, particularly tribal communities and others that really are devoid of significant numbers of economic resources, you can see high levels of depression. And so that self-medication, whether with drugs or alcohol or something else, combined with what Isaiah was saying about a departure from the sort of cultural traditions, can, I think, yield an increase in the incidence of violence. The one other thing I want to say to respond to your more recent caller about how one deals with some of these issues more proactively is that this new VAWA has a focus on homicide reduction, how you prevent domestic violence homicides by training law enforcement and victim service providers and court personnel to identify and connect high-risk victims to crisis intervention services before, frankly, they become murder victims. So this, again, speaks to why it is that we desperately need to get this new law through both houses of Congress and get it signed into law by the president as soon as we possibly can.
And what are your inclinations when it comes to passage? Do you think this will be passed or not?
Well, the bipartisan Senate version of the bill, which is S-47 for your listeners who are interested in going online and looking it up, already has 61 co-sponsors. So that really means that it's a bill that cannot be filibustered.
Mm-hmm.
So the hope is that when the bill comes to the floor of the Senate on Thursday, that we will have the kind of debate envisioned and discussed by Chairman Leahy of the Judiciary Committee and Senator Grassley, who's the ranking member, that we will have the discussion. Maybe there will be some amendments. We hope we can pretty much stick to the spirit and intent of the bill as it was introduced, and that it will be passed by the Senate, hopefully, on Thursday, and sent speedily over to the House.
Thanks, Steve, for the call. Ellen in Brookfield. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I think one of the best ways to get people to support anything in this country is to make it somehow selfish interest for them. And I think people who did not grow up in violence or have not suffered it don't have a clue how much it saps citizens of their energy to be productive in society. It saps a child's, because even if a child's not being beaten to witness it, destroys your energy. It destroys your self-confidence. The anxiety that you live under takes away your ability to excel in school, to excel in anything else. There are those few people who do, but for the most part, what it does is create a lack of ability to outwardly focus and become what you need to be. And from a selfish standpoint, in a country that is losing its top status, we need everybody who is born in this country to have the energy they need to be successful, to be creative, and to create a better country for us, besides just the moral imperative of this. be selfish and say we want a better country, and therefore we need to have everybody have the energy they need to grow and to become, whether they're children or adults.
Thank you, Ellen, for the call. We have about 15 seconds. Lisa Lynn.
Yeah, well, I think Ellen is particularly correct with respect to young children. They model their behavior on what they grow up seeing in terms of interpersonal relationships. So they are definitely at risk, but also at risk of becoming abusers or victims themselves. And that certainly is, you know, responding to the needs of preparing this country and the next generation is certainly another strong reason to see this bill reauthorized as soon as possible.
Thank you, Lisa Lynn, so much for being with us. It was a very informative and important hour, I'd say. Thanks.
My privilege, Kathleen. Thank you very much.
Lisa Lynn Jacobs, Vice President for Government Relations at Legal Momentum, the Women's Legal Defense Fund. We thank her. We thank Amanda Magnus for producing this program, Katie Mattson for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for all of your calls and for listening. We'll be continuing with another hour following the news from National Public Radio coming up in just a moment. And we all write. We can become much better writers after listening to hour number two. Stay with us.